because it was so exciting to demonstrate. Oh, thank you. That, where do I push? Oh, wait a minute.
It's recording, David.
Oh, okay. So that the Earth is young. So tonight's talk, carbon dating and the age of the Earth. The Earth is young. Notice the emphasis there on the Earth is young. Next slide, please. Okay, now what we want to do is get just a little background first. So I'm sorry if you've been around this subject for a long time, because we want to start with the basics and make sure you understand the two models that we're going to talk about tonight. That of the evolution model, macroevolution, not micro variational small scale changes, because those really don't mean a thing. They're very minor. So you've got varieties of dogs, cats, horses, frogs. That's not the kind of variation we're talking about. We're talking about molecules evolving to men. Molecules to men, macroevolution. Well, point number one, the evolutionary view was started from this concept of what's called uniformitarianism. Okay, and this was developed by James Hutton and then later on Charles Lyell. It's the idea that when we look at the processes that we see operating today, they pretty much can be extrapolated back in time to say this is exactly the way things were in the past. So when we see things like erosion, deposition, sedimentation, glaciation, and so forth, then that allows us to say, oh, those processes, they've been going on since the very beginning. And they haven't changed, and so we know, based on current rates of those processes, that this is how we should interpret the Earth. That's what the evolution model essentially says. Now, they, in recent years, have come away from that a little bit. They now acknowledge things like certain types of catastrophes. Could never acknowledge the idea of a worldwide flood, because that sounds too Christian. We can't have this idea that the Bible is correct. So we won't use the word catastrophism until they thought that the creationists were long ago dead and none of them were there to argue with them. And so then they started to say neo-catastrophism. So things like the destruction of the dinosaurs by an extraterrestrial impact is now pretty widely accepted, but not the concept of a worldwide flood. Point number two, the fact of evolution, macro and micro. Nobody, even creationists, would disagree with small-scale variational changes. We don't like that word evolution because it implies something very different. There's no problem with micro variational changes, but macro evolution is the concept that everything has evolved through time from its simplest state, starting with a Big Bang some 13 billion years ago and evolving to what we see today with man at the pinnacle of that evolution so far. Okay? And then they would argue that the Earth, based on the fact, quote, fact of evolution, is about 4.6 billion years old, with the universe being about 13 billion years before present. That number changes like every year. They used to say 15 billion, 18 billion. They throw billions around like they're nothing. Okay, and even the age of the Earth has doubled every 20 or 30 years. It's doubled in their estimates. Why? Because time is the hero of the plot. You see, time can do anything. Time can evolve things under the right conditions. So if I have, 50,000 monkeys sitting at typewriters and they just peck at that, eventually they will create Shakespeare. Well, I don't think so. Number one, the typewriters will break down or the computers will break down. The monkeys aren't going to live that long to type it. And who's going to save it, by the way? So that's a very poor argument that is still used to this day. But the estimate for the evolutionary model is about 4.6 billion years before present for the Earth and about 13 billion years before present for the universe. Next slide. Now, the creation model, of course, is very, very different. It emphasizes catastrophism. A worldwide massive flood, as it says in the Bible, in Genesis chapter 7 and parts of the New Testament, Peter and others, the world that then was overflowed and destroyed by water. People don't realize it. You say, well, is there enough water to cover the whole earth? Do you realize if we didn't have the high mountains we have today, you could cover the earth to a depth of 2 miles? 2 miles. We have 350 million cubic miles of water. 71% of the entire Earth's surface is covered by water right now. Okay? So we have a tremendous amount of water, and if you didn't have the high mountains that we have today, you could easily cover the whole Earth. Say, well then, how come it isn't covered right now? Because it says in the book of Psalms, the mountains rose up, the valleys sank down, and the oceans went down, back down into their basins. So that's where the water went, back into the ocean basins. The creation model says that the Earth is probably very young, only thousands of years old. In fact, depending on how you argue with the genealogies, some people think there are gaps, some think there are not. But even if you argue the genealogies, you can't get to a maximum age of more than 10,000 years. The Earth, by all standards that the Bible teaches that the Earth is young. Let's be honest about that. That's what it teaches. Okay? Creation ex nihilo, Psalm 33:6. I've already mentioned that God spoke things into existence. The universe was created by the first cause. There has to be a first cause. Otherwise, if God didn't create, then who created God? And then who created him? And who created him? The answer is that God is not a created being. In Hebrews, it says God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Christ is, okay? And Christ is God. Now, animals and plants of the past must have been contemporary. So instead of dinosaurs going extinct 65 million years ago during the Triassic Cretaceous events, then dinosaurs may have lived ecologically in different locations than human beings. So, for example, it's the same reason why a whale doesn't crash through one of these walls and just kill us all. It's alive at the same time we are. It's in an ecologically different environment. You say, well, there's no evidence that men and dinosaurs lived together. Oh, yes, there is. Okay, if you look in Job chapter 40 and 41, Behemoth and Leviathan seem to be really clear descriptions. One, a marine creature, a marine reptile, like a dinosaur, and one, a land creature, like a dinosaur. We see legend of Beowulf, and so forth. George the Dragon Slayer. There's good evidence that dinosaurs and men have lived together. You say, well, then why aren't they alive today? Well, just like many other types of creatures. I worked down at the Brea Tar Pits for many years, and there's lots of creatures that are extinct now, but that's going the wrong direction. That's not evolution, that's extinction. So woolly mammoths that lived here in Southern California are not alive today. Camels lived in Southern California, okay, and yet they're extinct. But so extinction is the opposite, because we're under the curse. Romans chapter 8 says that the entire universe groans unto this day. Okay, so the creation model says the Earth is young. It's dominated by catastrophism, the greatest of which would have been a worldwide flood. And that the Earth is quite young, only thousands of years ago. And that God, and in his creation, Psalm 33:6, he created by speaking things into existence, not by evolution. There's no confusion on that. Where does Pat Robertson get this idea? The Bible clearly says that. Okay, so Pat, then just don't believe in the Bible if you want to say you don't think that creation is so right. That's what it teaches, okay? Have a conversation with Pastor Paul if you don't think I'm right on that. No, I don't want to put you on the spot, but we agree that it clearly teaches that. Okay, next slide. Now, we want to start looking specifically at carbon-14, radiocarbon. Carbon isotopes, okay? So now that word, what it means is the element carbon comes in different forms. That's all that means. The element carbon comes in different forms. We have well over 100 different elements. They are the basic substance that no matter how far you break something down, the chemist will tell you, it's still that substance, okay? And there's well over 100 of them, like oxygen or neon or hydrogen. These are all examples of elements. And carbon is an important element. It actually is in all of our bodies. We are carbon-based organisms. Well, there are at least three different kinds of carbon, only one of which is actually radioactive. The word radioactive means it changes through time. Radiocarbon, and I'll talk more about this in the next slide. Sorry, we have to do some background to get you to the point where you can understand my argument here. Radiocarbon forms basically in the upper atmosphere. We will very quickly go through that process. Radiocarbon circulates in both the atmosphere, the nitrogen-oxygen atmosphere, which goes up about 100 miles, and in the biosphere, living things. The word bio, bios, is life, and sphere means circle. Circle of life. Where have we heard that? The Lion King? Okay, next slide. Now, there's three forms of carbon. Look up at the top there. Carbon 12, which is about 98.9% of all the carbon, is stable carbon 12. Okay? And that it has 6 neutrons and 6 protons. So you add those together and you get that number that goes along with the fact that it's carbon. Look in the second column, carbon 13. Only a very small percentage, 0.011% of all the carbon is carbon 13, but it is also stable. In the nucleus of the atom of a carbon, it has 7 neutrons, I should say, sorry, and 6 protons. Okay? Then we look at carbon 14, which is a very, very small percentage of the total carbon. Only 0.0001% of all the carbon is radioactive carbon. Very small amount. And carbon 14, through time, changes to nitrogen 14. So it has 8 neutrons and 6 protons. These are all carbon, but they're different setups of carbon based on the particles, subatomic particles in the nucleus. Okay, so that's important that you know. Most carbon is stable. It's not radioactive, but only carbon 14 is radioactive. Next slide. Now, what can be dated by radioactive carbon? We never date rocks. Why? Because you're only dating organic substances. Now, what do I mean by organic? I do not mean you go to the grocery store and they didn't put pesticides on it. That's not what we mean in science. That's dealing with, you know, fruits and vegetables at the grocery store. But what organic means is once living things. Normally, rocks do not contain carbon. Only organic, once living substances do. So, for example, things like wood, bone, shells, tissues, coal, and yeah, I said it. Look at that last word. Dinosaurs can be dated using carbon 14. Ooh, now we're starting to get interesting. Okay, next slide. Now, how does carbon 14 work? Stay with me on this. It's going to be a little technical, but I promise if you can follow this, that'll help you understand the key points towards the end when we actually determine what it all means. So the sun has what you call cosmic rays. These are rays that come in as a result of the sun's energy, and the sun puts out 7 electromagnetic rays. 6 of them we can't see. Like, for example, ultraviolet rays and radio waves, gamma rays. And we can't see these, but we are able to see a small portion of that electromagnetic spectrum, which is visible sunlight. And that bombards the Earth. There's what's called the solar wind. It actually travels from the sun at about 800,000 miles per hour, crashes to the upper atmosphere of the Earth, but we have what are called the Van Allen radiation belts that are put out by the Earth's magnetic strength, which is at the center, the Earth's magnet, and it blocks most of that radiation from coming in. Okay, you see the aurora borealis as a result of that, which they call the northern lights. That's the collision between those. But some of that energy makes its way into the upper atmosphere. That interacts with the nitrogen in the upper atmosphere, which is 78% of all the atmosphere. Most people think, oh, air is just made of, you know, oxygen. But actually, most of it is made of nitrogen. And it interacts with the nitrogen. Plants take in that radioactive carbon as a result of the photosynthetic process. Some people think that plants get their food because they have roots and they dig down, you know, and they get their food that way. No, plants get their food by taking the sun's radiant energy and converting that into chemical energy. The word photo means light. Synthesis means to put together. So they take the radiant energy, convert it into chemical energy. In that process of taking that light in, they take carbon-14 into the plant material. Animals then, like cows, eat the plants. We eat the plants and the animals. So every living thing takes in carbon 14. Now, at the point where you die, you stop taking in carbon 14, and we can measure the amount of carbon that's there at a known established rate. The carbon decays back out. What does it decay into? It decays into nitrogen, and we can measure that decay rate to see how old something is. Next slide. So here's a summary, because that was a lot of information, and if you don't have a background, I hope I didn't lose you, and some of you are starting to nod off. So let me summarize what I just said. Cosmic rays bring in the radioactive carbon. Photosynthesis is the process by which plants take in that radioactive information. Then animals eat the plants, everything, including humans. We all die. When we die, that carbon 14 that is in our bodies, we've been taking it in our whole lives through food, now begins to change into nitrogen 14. We can go into the lab with the right equipment and measure the rate of decay of that carbon 14. And the rate of decay is that half of the carbon, that's called the half-life, half of that carbon 14 will change to nitrogen 14 in 5,730 years. It's a known measurable rate. And nobody disagrees with me on that, by the way. All science agrees. This method was started way back in the 1940s by Willard Libby. Everyone agrees that the decay rate or the half-life of carbon-14 is 5,730 years. So let's say I have a bone up here. I have a bone. This is the bone instead of a book. And this bone the organism died 5,730 years ago. I should be able to measure it and see that half of the total material in there is carbon-14, and half of it now is converted to nitrogen-14. So I can tell that this actually is 5,730 years. Now, if three-fourths of it has changed from carbon-14 to nitrogen, now that takes over 11,000 years because the remaining one-fourth of the material, now half of that decays into nitrogen. And so with every increasing half-life, half of the amount of carbon that's left will have changed into nitrogen. Okay, if you're not quite following all this, just hang in there. I'll see if I can clarify it a little bit more as we go. Next slide. Now, the rate of radiocarbon decay. The nuclei, or the center of the carbon-14 atom, is unstable. With time, these change into nitrogen-14. A neutron breaks down to a proton, an electron. The electron is ejected. You don't need to know all this, but I'm just telling you anyways. And this is called beta decay. There are different kinds of decay for different radioactive atoms. There's obviously an alpha decay and a beta decay. If you know Greek, then you know those words. Used to be that grocery store called Alpha Beta, but that really dates me, you see, so I won't mention that. Don't forget, carbon-14 decays at a measurable rate. This is what I want you to get. Measurable rate, the decay rate, 5,730 years. So half of the carbon-14 will change into nitrogen-14. Good. Some of you are listening. That's excellent. Next slide. Now, after the death of an animal, look over here on the left, it no longer eats. And so it doesn't add carbon-14 to its body. So the C-14 is steadily lost into nitrogen-14. You say, well, why? Because carbon-14, being a radioactive element, that means it's unstable. It will not stay the same. Most elements that are not radioactive, they'll simply stay the same. Oxygen will stay the same. Certain isotopes of it, or nitrogen, or certain other, most of the elements, they don't change with time. But the ones that are unstable, which I'm not going to get into the technicalities of why they're unstable, but just know that radioactive elements are elements that are not stable, and through time, they change into another element. Now, to understand what this means, think of an hour clock. If we have an hour clock, because in the past, you know, they didn't have clocks, and so they had to find some way to measure time. They started off by using the sundial, but what do you do on a cloudy day? And what do you do at nighttime? You can't measure, you know, what time of the day it is. A sundial measures things by telling you where a certain shadow is, and they would have an idea, well, where's that shadow at a certain time of the day? And then they went to things like hourglasses. And so, you know, roughly how long does it take for this container of sand to run through the system? So they set it up so it was about what they thought was an hour. Well, on a long-term basis, that's how carbon-14 works. It decays at a very straightforward, known rate through time, so that after half of the material has decayed away into nitrogen-14, that would be 5,730 years. Okay, next slide. Now, after living organisms die, they no longer add carbon-14 to their body. It stops being added because you do that through eating. Thus, the carbon-14 is lost over time, changes into nitrogen-14. Obviously, I want you to get that point because I've said it about four times now. After only one half life, half of that original C14 will remain, but only after two half lives, only one fourth of that carbon-14 will remain. Most of it then will have decayed into nitrogen-14, three-fourths of it. After only 10 half-lives of measuring this, here's the part that becomes really important. 10 half-lives, which is 57,300 years, hardly any of that carbon-14 will remain. Most of it will be changed to nitrogen-14. Now, if this continues on with the remaining half of the material changing, and then the remaining of that half of the material changing, and then so forth, After a million years, if all the atoms making up the entire Earth were radiocarbon, no carbon-14 would be left at any time. Okay, now I'm being really generous. It's only really about 100,000 years that all the carbon would be lost in any once living organism. And we can directly measure that so that anything older than 100,000 years, but let's be generous, we'll go to a million years, would no longer exist. That organism could not have carbon-14 in it. We can directly measure it to see what the decay rate is. The decay rate is every 5,730 years, half of the carbon changes to nitrogen. So the half-life less and less and less with each half-life exists. So that after 100,000, and we'll be even more generous, after a million, you would have no carbon-14 left in any once living organism. So if I pull something up out of the ground, take it to a carbon lab, and there's carbon-14 in it, it has to be less than 100,000 years old, and certainly, even if I'm absolutely generous, less than a million years old. Okay, that's a crucial point that I hope you got that. Next slide. So we can look at what's called an exponential decay law. That is, if we look at the decay of carbon-14, so after one half-life, 5,730 years, the amount of carbon goes down. After two half-lives, a lot less. Four half-lives, really a small amount. So by the time we get close up over here to about 100,000 years, the amount of C14 is so little, you can't even measure it with your best instruments. It's very low. I'm being generous when I even say 100,000. We said a million, but I'm being generous even with 100,000. Okay, next slide. Now, if we look at this chart, we can see the percentage of modern carbon, the PMC, in that middle section as we go down our half-life. So one half-life, 50%, two half-lives, 25%, three half-lives, only 12.5%. You get the idea that with each 5,730 years, the amount of carbon goes down dramatically. Look at this. After only 18 half-lives, okay, that's less than 100,000 years, you're looking at 0.00381470%. A tiny fraction the time you get close to 100,000 years. There's almost none. But let's be generous. We're going to give a million years, just to be safe, because let's say by some chance our calculations are off a little bit. So that's, you know, a factor of 10 to get up to a million. Next slide. Okay, now, how do we measure the carbon-14 in fossils? That's a crucial question. How do we get these numbers that we're talking about of half-lives of 5,700 years? The AMS, which is the Accelerator Mass Spectrometer, that's the instrument that actually measures the amount of carbon-14 in a system. AMS is capable of detection of one radioactive carbon atom, one, in 100 quadrillion carbon-12 atoms. Okay, did you get that number? This is equivalent to detecting one unique sand grain in a 100-mile beach. That's how precise the Accelerator Mass Spectrometer is. I mean, it is precise. One atom, okay, in 100 quadrillion. Bullet number three. Every piece of ancient material, carbon tested, has contained measurable quantities of radioactive carbon. What? How can that be, Professor Phillips? How can that be? That's impossible. Aren't there dinosaurs that are 65 million years old? Aren't there fossils from the Cambrian that are 500 million years old? Look at that. Every piece of ancient material, carbon tested, has contained measurable quantities of radiocarbon. Are you starting to see the problem here? Are you starting to see, well, wait a minute, you should be asking the question already, how can some of these fossils be hundreds of millions of years old if that's the case? Good, you're starting to get it. For example, fossils of coal, oil, natural gas, limestone, fossiliferous limestone, marble, graphite, these all have to contain organic substances in them, from different strata, in other words, supposed different layers of time, right? Because the evolutionists have a whole sequence of layers. In fact, when I was an undergrad, you had to learn those with the little mnemonic saying. That was mnemonic, not demonic. Mnemonic saying. Certain old stones delight my paleontology professor. Cambrian, Ordovician, Silurian, Devonian, all these were time periods, each one with different environments and different organisms that lived at different times. But is that possible? Go back to bullet number three. Every piece of ancient material, carbon tested, has contained measurable quantities of radiocarbon. There's a problem. I hope you're starting to see the problem. Next slide. Now, how does the Accelerator Mass Spectrometer actually work? Well, I'm not going to go through, we have a diagram down here. I'm not going to go through that. Everyone here would be sound asleep, and then I'd have to wake you up and say, okay, now we can move on. One time I was in a graduate class, and a student just couldn't take it and fell asleep and was snoring while the teacher was teaching. Oh, my goodness. The Accelerator Mass Spectrometry is an ultra-sensitive method for analyzing isotopes. Don't forget, an isotope is simply the different types of the same element. So carbon-12, carbon-13, carbon-14. The AMS has application in many different sciences. Particularly, it's been used in archaeology because there's lots of once organic things that you can date. You can date wood beams. You can date coal, charcoal or coal that's been used by humans. So it has strong applications in archaeology, but it's also applicable to paleontology because these are once living substances. And since you could date bones and you can date shells and you can date things that were once living, it has application for paleontology also. This is a precise instrument that is highly accurate in what it has to do because that's an important point. Next slide. Now, how does the AMS actually work? Modern laboratories measure that radiocarbon with a sophisticated instrument. We already know it's called the AMS or Accelerator Mass Spectrometer. This is a much improved system over old methods, which require more of the object to be burned. So this would have application for something like the shroud in case they ever decided to retest it with carbon dating. You would only need a tiny little fragment. This machine is able to count carbon-14 atoms one at a time. It can detect one radioactive C14 atom in 100 quadrillion regular carbon-12 atoms. It can be checked for contamination. You might say, well, how do we know it's accurate? Well, you can use what you call a blank sample holder. That sample holder has no specimen in it, and you simply put it in the machine. It's called a control, if you've had science classes, to make sure that what you're testing is really what you think you're testing. So you put that card holder, the thing that holds the specimen into the machine, and you can see that it must come back zero. If it doesn't come back zero, then there's some kind of carbon on there. You know, maybe the technician was sweaty that day, or, you know, the guy loses his hair and the hair follicle fell out, or he had, you know, sweat on his palms, something that contaminated the machine. So they run that in there with the holder to make sure that it's reaching zero to confirm that it's accurate. If you put a bone in there, that's really what you're testing and not some other piece of carbon-14. Next slide. We're getting there. Hang in there. The finds are consistent with a young Earth creationism. Okay, that's really important that you understand that. The finds are consistent with a young Earth. Old Earth claims results are thought to be due to contamination. That, you know, the old earthers don't know what to do with this. So they say, well, the numbers you get, they must be some kind of contamination because we know the earth is old. Well, really, how do you know the earth is old? Because evolution's a fact. Well, how do you know evolution's a fact? Well, because the earth is old. But how do you know the earth is old? Because evolution's a fact. How do you know evolution's a fact? Because the earth is old. It's called a tautology. Okay? We scientists know, anytime you see a paper that says that, be really clear. It's like, well, excuse me, how do they know? How do they know? How do they know? They're committed to evolution because an old Earth is what you have to have if evolution is true. If the Earth is young, that eliminates evolution. Things don't have enough time to change from molecules to men. So an evolutionist will argue to the death that the Earth is old. But AMS technology refutes old Earth claims. Specimens are highly clean and treated with acids to make sure there's no contaminated. Once again, that blank sample is put in there to make sure it yields a zero for that AMS to verify that what you're actually getting is the testing of that bone or shell or object that you then put in there to verify it's accurate. And really, nobody doubts that the AMS is an accurate system for radiocarbon dating things because it's been tested over and over and over and over. Next slide. Now, a confirmation of young Earth based on fossils. We have to actually test this. I keep saying that, you know, our carbon dating shows the Earth to be young, but let's look at particular cases to see if that's true. We're going to look at fossil coal. Notice the exclamation point. You get a young Earth. We're going to look at diamonds. You get a young Earth. And yes, we're going to look at dinosaurs and you also get a young Earth. Okay? Now, what's so fascinating about dinosaurs, we have a confirmation. How many of you know the name J. Werner Wallace wrote that book, The Cold Case? Some of you hopefully have read it. Nobody's read it? Oh, you guys have to get that. Okay, in God Is Not Dead, he, along with Lee Strobel, was one of the people that testified. That was J. Werner Wallace who was up on the stand. And he's what you call a forensic detective, okay? So he's kind of a CSI, only in real life kind of a guy. J. Werner Wallace, a cold case. And really what he does is he investigates cold cases. So he used his forensic abilities to test Christianity. Well, how do we know the Gospels were really written by the guys that claimed that they are the ones that wrote it? He used that ability, and it's a remarkable book. You should really get him. If you're interested in apologetics, J. Werner Wallace, The Cold Case. It's excellent. You can get it on Amazon, I'm sure. Well, what he says is, look, if I have two different bits of collaborating evidence, then my case is much stronger than if I just argue from one case. So look at this. So what I'm saying is when we do the carbon-14 studies, and yes, we've dated lots of dinosaur skeletons by carbon-14. I'll give you some of that information, and you can confirm this your own self by going on the internet. When I date dinosaurs by carbon-14, guess what? They always come back with discernible carbon in them. Whoops. But I thought dinosaurs died off 65 million years ago. That's right. That's what you're taught. During the Cretaceous time period, dinosaurs died off 65 million years ago. But carbon dating of dinosaurs shows them to be young. And many of you have heard about this, collaborating evidence, a totally different line of evidence that, as I mentioned, two collaborating pieces of evidence strengthen my case incredibly. That is, soft dinosaur tissue has been found numerous cases And that shouldn't be. How do you get something that's 65 million years old last with soft tissue in it for 65 million years? Impossible. If you know anything about the decay of things, the first thing that happens when you die, within 24 hours, rigor mortis sets in, your body becomes like stone, the muscles no longer contract, and you are literally eaten from the inside, sorry if I say it this way, but you're eaten from the inside out by the bacteria that's in you. Okay? Now remember the case where Christ comes to the tomb of Lazarus, and he says, okay, open that up, we're going to bring him out. And they say, wait, don't do that. He's been dead for 3 days. It'll just reek. You can't, he stinketh. You can't go in there and do that. Remember that case? And he says, bring him out. And not only does he bring him back from the dead, but he would have had to completely regenerate all those cells that had deteriorated in only 3 days. Look, we've got a tremendous numbers of studies to show that tissue cannot survive for millions of years. Bones, okay, maybe, but not soft tissue. It will rot away. We can test this in the lab to see if that's not the case. And I have studies that I'll pass on to someone if they want to see that. Things, soft tissue does not last millions of years. So Mary Schweitzer, who's the one who's famous, not Albert Schweitzer, Mary Schweitzer, who's famous for finding these, and who is an evolutionist, not a creationist, as soon as she reported this to her major supervisor, who was Jack Horner, and Dr. Jack Horner said, oh, the creationists are going to love you. That's right. We do love her because she's helped to strengthen our case. So I have two lines of collaborating evidence I'm going to talk about. Carbon-14, which shows carbon still in the dinosaurs, the implication that they're young, not old, and soft tissue in dinosaurs that shouldn't be there after 65 million years. Next slide. Let's look at some of these cases. So what they did, here's a histogram showing that, represents a C14 analysis by rate, radioactive, and age of the Earth. This was done basically through Institute for Creation Research. The coal was now analyzed, and every one of these ancient coal specimens, no matter what alleged time period they came from, all the way from Pennsylvanian time period to Eocene time period, which is some 300 million years difference in time, and they all came back with discernible indigenous coal still in them. I'm sorry, indigenous carbon still in the coal. That's impossible because we know the rate of decay of carbon-14. Next slide. Okay, so coal is buried vegetation material, almost entirely composed of carbon, and if it crystallizes, it then becomes diamond. Samples, pieces of coal from U.S. coal beds were gathered, ranging from Eocene time period, which was about supposed to be 40 million years old by the evolutionists, to 320 million years before present, and all of those samples contain similar radiocarbon levels equivalent to between 48 and 50,000 years before present. They all had discernible indigenous carbon-14 still in them. But that's impossible if these samples are the ages that they're supposed to be. Strike number one, coal does not demonstrate an old Earth by carbon-14. Next slide. Okay, results of AMS, accelerated mass spectrometer carbon analysis of 10 rate samples of coals. Here's the conclusion. They came from all different locations. They came from different time periods. And they all had, look over here, discernible carbon still in them. Folks, anything over 100,000 and certainly by over a million should have no carbon left in it. And here are samples that are tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of years old, with discernible carbon still in them. Look at the column all the way to the far right. And notice these come from different areas, different time periods based on evolution, and yet all still had discernible carbon in them. That's impossible if those samples are as old as claimed. Next slide. Now, diamonds also confirm a young Earth. You thought diamonds were a girl's best friend, but diamonds can also be shown to demonstrate a young Earth. These substances are known to be one of the hardest natural materials on Earth. They are, therefore, very resistant to chemical alteration or contamination. They come from deep in the Earth. When carbon gets compressed, it gets crystallized. Diamonds, that is a crystalline pure carbon, is formed deep in the Earth's crust and upper mantle, brought to the surface by volcanic pipes or magma called lava when it reaches the surface. Measurable radiocarbon in diamonds has recently been discovered. What? But that's impossible, because diamonds are supposed to be millions or even billions of years old. How could there be discernible carbon in them? Diamonds cannot be contaminated. So you might try to get out of it that way. You might say, oh, well, maybe the carbon somehow got into the diamonds. Nope. Diamonds aren't easy to be contaminated because they're so deep under the ground. You can't have contamination from the atmosphere or the biosphere. They form deep under the ground, not in the atmosphere. Next slide. The RATE team analyzed 12 diamond samples for C14 content. These specimens came from West and South Africa, approximately 20.25 carats in weight, or 50 milligrams, not the big rocks that you see when girls, you know, get engaged, but just industrial size diamonds. The AMS, or accelerated mass spectrometer, analyzed all of these specimens, requiring the diamonds to be destroyed. They were crushed to small chips, burned, and then converted to CO2, carbon dioxide. This gas is then condensed to a tiny speck of what's called graphite, which is then analyzed by the AMS. What were the results? Next slide. And you see that, look over on the right, we don't have time to go through all this, but there's discernible carbon in every single specimen. Didn't matter what time period it was from or how old it was supposed to be, we found that discernible carbon is still in there. What's the implication? The implication is that it has to be less than a million years old and certainly less than 100,000 years old. I don't know any other answer. Next slide. Diamond conclusion. Similar to the result of coal, all 12 diamond samples had detectable C14 content. The RATE research marked for the first time C14 measurements had been taken on diamonds. The presence of C14 in old coal samples is a major conflict with the long age time scale and confirms a young age, and so do the diamonds. Next slide. Now, what about dinosaurs? Because this is probably the most interesting, so I saved it for the last so that you guys won't fall asleep. Fossil dinosaurs confirm a young age. And by the way, there's been a lot more studies just since I put this PowerPoint together last summer. There's been a wave of additional new information. I have some of the journals up here if somebody ever wants to look at them. Dinosaurs are thought by evolutionary standards to have lived approximately 225 million years before present to 65 million years before present during the Mesozoic era, which includes the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous time periods. That's where they got the name Jurassic Park. Bullet number two, if this is true based on a half-life of 5,730 years, after only 1 million years, no C14 should be detectable in dinosaur bones. Ah, but look at bullet three. Every dinosaur tested dozens of specimens, and I have the papers to prove this if you want to look at them. They've been found with detectable C14 in the bones. What? That's impossible. Didn't dinosaurs die off 65 million years ago? No, I don't think so. Next slide. Here you see some of the dinosaurs that have been dated and the ages they come back. They all come back between about 20 and about 50,000 years before present. Okay, and I'll explain why, you know, if you think and want to argue that the Earth is 6,000 to 10,000 years old, that still seems a little high. But the point is, it's not millions of years, so the idea of evolution is dead. Okay, now I'll explain why that might be a little high for 6,000 to 10,000 in just a minute. The point is, all of these dinosaurs have been dated using the carbon-14 method, and I'm going to give you a website to go to verify this. If someone wants to verify this, go to the website dinosaurc14ages.com. These were done through University of Georgia, and now even more studies and even more soft dinosaur tissue has been verified that it has carbon-14 in it. So carbon-14 does not argue positively in favor that these dinosaurs are that old, but it destroys the concept that they are millions of years old. Next slide. Now, in addition to that, I mentioned that independent evidence from soft tissue in dinosaurs also confirms a young age of the Earth. Soft tissue has been found in many dinosaur bones. What? That's impossible. They should have long ago rotted away. And they should have been destroyed, including things, proteins like collagen and hemoglobin, blood vessels, and possibly even red blood cells. And more recently, there's even evidence that DNA, viable intact DNA, has been discovered. So Mary Schweitzer is the main evolutionist. There were evolutionists before that that had discovered this. And then the work has been further done by Mark Armitage, who is a creationist. He's actually spoken here a few times in years gone by. And Mark, they actually took the dinosaur that he found was a Triceratops horn. In the horn of the Triceratops, he found soft tissue, and it was verified to have particular types of tissues, such as osteocytes and osteoblasts. We don't have time to go into what those are, but they're confirmed as actually being in there. There were some people originally arguing that this was what you call biofilm or bacteria that had gone in there. But since about 2010, everybody admits it is not bacteria. These are real soft tissues. Now, we took the soft tissue from Mark's Triceratops horn and carbon dated it, and it consistently came back with carbon still in it, confirming the other ages and dates that I had at between 20 and 50,000 years before present. There should be no carbon in there at all, folks, let alone soft tissue and C14. Next slide. Okay. Evolutionists have responded to these findings. You might want to say, well, what do the evolutionists say? By suggesting that the process involving certain types of substances in the blood, such as the hemoglobin, have iron and hydroxyl radicals, and this somehow preserves that tissue for 65 million years. I don't think so. However, creationists, and I brought the paper, creation chemists, these two chemists, DeMassa and Boudreau, have documented that there's many problems with this idea. What they say, they conclude that 2 years of studies doesn't extrapolate to 68 million. You might be able to preserve certain tissues for a few extra years, but you couldn't preserve them. Every study that we have says you can't preserve those soft tissues for millions of years. So now who has the faith and who is doing the empirical science studies? It isn't the evolutionist. Next slide. Okay, radiocarbon explained by evolution. Evolutionists are in a quandary over this. Radiocarbon is an accepted method, they say, for dating things like archaeological specimens, but not old things. It's not commonly used for dating dinosaurs. Why? Because the range of the method is thought to be too short. Yeah, it's too short because you believe the Earth is old. Quote, we know the last dinosaur died 65 million years ago. Therefore, the method doesn't work on old specimens. Yeah, because things aren't that old. You see the circle there? Circular reason? Contamination may also be possible somehow from machine. Maybe that's what's causing it. Next slide. We're going to start wrapping up here. Objections answered, though. The AMS has been checked prior to testing and finds zero atoms of C14 when there's no sample represented. It can be verified and checked to make sure you're not getting contamination. Workers are extremely careful when they take samples in order to prevent contamination. They wear gloves. They put things in baggies. They tighten them up so that that can't be. The overwhelming evidence suggests that carbon-14 found in tested specimens is internal and not due to contamination. Next slide. Well, the radiocarbon puzzle, okay, this is part of the data that still needs to be worked on and confirmed. Even though radiocarbon date specimen consistently show a young Earth, eliminates the possibility of evolution, you still get an age that's somewhere between 30 and 50,000 for these materials, and that doesn't precisely match the 6 to 10 for the Bible, okay? Well, if it matched up perfectly, then you'd have to say, well, you're telling a just-so story, Professor Phillips. But notice that it's a little bit still too old, but it does demonstrate that it's young. Okay, so there are some possibilities. Very quickly, the production of C14 in the atmosphere may have been slightly different in the past, and several other things. The decay of the Earth's magnetic field could affect the amount of carbon as it's created in the atmosphere. And there's a number of other possibilities that may help us to eventually resolve this. We do know that up until 400 BC, the C14 could be verified and checked precisely to see if it's accurate. Beyond that, they use dendrochronology, which is not necessarily that accurate itself. The point that I want to make, the conclusion, and I think I'm going to stop because I'm out of time, C14 shows organisms that still have carbon in them, that argues for a young age, and then you add in the soft tissue, conclusively, this is so damaging to the theory of evolution, it will never recover. Okay? The emperor has no clothes, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? I guess I'm like that little boy. Hey, just, no. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and stop at this point, and Paul, if you want to... Or do I need you to do it? Let them ask questions?
Yeah, why don't you just take questions?
Let me supervise that. Okay, let's go ahead and take questions. There's more, but I think that's about as much as you can stand. You know, it's kind of overwhelming. And you got to understand, I'm simplifying. I really am.
David, you want to turn on the lights right behind you on the wall there?
Yes.
Since we're done with the slides.
Okay.
So, any questions?
So please ask questions and challenge me. If you think I'm wrong, challenge me and tell me why you think I'm wrong. I don't have a problem with people disagreeing with me. My students, if they disagree, I just give them an F. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Okay? Yes, go ahead.
I just want to thank you because this is the first time I've ever understood carbon dating and all of
that. Oh, what a compliment.
I have looked at those books and they just look like Greek to me.
But it's hard.
You've told to me, you've made it so much easier to understand, and I want to read more.
Thank you. That's... really encouraging. Sometimes I get a little discouraged, and when you're in ministry and you want people to understand things and get things, and they don't see the importance of it, to me it's like really important. But I realize that you have your own lives, and it may not be as important to you. So when someone says something like that, it really means a lot to me. It encourages me to keep going. Thank you. I think you had a question over here, Lorraine.
If you ask an evolutionist scientist about the carbon-14 dating decay, and so how do they defend it?
I'm so glad you asked that question. Paul, forward to a couple of slides. I want you to hear a conversation. Go ahead, one more. Keep going. Now, if you hit this button... This is a discussion. Can you turn up the volume on your computer so they can hear that? I want you to hear a discussion. This gentleman named Bob Enyart is a Christian radio talk show host in Denver. And he calls Jack Horner. Jack Horner is a professional PhD paleontologist. Okay, can you guys hear that? Listen really carefully. That's my fault. We should have thought about a mic. What happened? Did it stop?
Okay, so he's calling Jack Horner, you're saying?
Yes, he's calling Jack Horner, and he's going to ask him, why don't you date the T-Rex that you found with the soft tissue in it? Why don't you date it by carbon-14? That's the secretary. Okay, they're saying they can't hear it, Paul.
They're transferring him over to the office of Jack Horner.
Yes. Okay, now I'll just ask you to write the website down, and because it's a little hard to hear. But if you go to YouTube, and put in call to Jack Horner, okay? And what happens is Bob Enyart asks him, well, Jack Horner, why don't you just date the soft tissue that you have in this dinosaur, why don't you date it by carbon-14? And what he actually says, oh, we're not going to use that method. Well, why not? Well, because it gives too young of an age. It's no good. What? It gives too young of an age? Yeah. So they're not going to support anything that is arguing for a young Earth. So they censor the information. And that's exactly... what is done, and there's the key example of that's done. Okay, so you'll have to listen to that on your own, but it's Bob Enyart, call to Jack Horner. Okay, and you can get it on YouTube if you try to bring that up. And I apologize, I forgot that we needed a microphone on that. So that's my fault. But it documents the very question, Lorraine's question, that what would evolutionists say? Well, what can they say? If they're a committed evolutionist, they're going to reject the information. They're going to say, oh, it must just be contamination, but you cannot try to pull that one. It won't work. We have the AMS, very sophisticated. It's been confirmed and verified that it does measure things accurately. Okay, and so if you don't want to believe it, that's your problem. But that's based on your religious conviction. See how I spun that around on them? That's your religious conviction. That's not science. Science suggests strongly from carbon-14 dating and soft tissue, the Earth is young, folks. And that's exactly what the Bible teaches. And if some people don't want to accept that, okay, I respect William Lane Craig. I respect some of the other Christians who don't want to go along with that, but why is it they don't think that's true? Well, I'll tell you, because they think that science has proven, when it hasn't, that the universe is old, and their whole agenda behind that is because they are evolutionists. And so they don't want to get embarrassed. They don't want, oh, you're one of those young Earth creationists. Did you lose your mind? No, I don't think so. If you look at the data, it argues very successfully and very strongly. And I don't think my presentation tonight was in any way religious. I presented good, solid scientific data that argues very strongly for young Earth. Yes, sir?
You get a short answer why the C12 was more prevalent than C14? You had it on one of your slides.
Well, that is pretty much true for all elements. The non-radioactive elements are far more abundant. It's unusual that elements are radioactive. I don't know, but I think that could be part of the curse, as it says in Romans chapter 8, because everything is degenerative. Every system, our own bodies, you know, the whole universe, we look out there and we see supernovas, and everything is deteriorating, breaking down, which is another argument, strong argument for creation, because if I go backwards in time, there's less entropy or less decay, and as I go back far enough, then there's no entropy and the universe is in a state of perfection. But how did it get that way? It couldn't have created itself because the first law of thermodynamics says that energy and matter are neither created nor destroyed. So it couldn't have created itself, but it's here. So what was the first cause? And I would argue the first cause is external to the creation. That first cause has to be a creator God who is outside of the universe and not subject to the very laws of physics and chemistry that he created. He's eternal. And if he's God, he has to be eternal, because then if he's not eternal, then someone had to create him, and someone had to create him, and someone had to create him infinitum, as they say, back forever. So God's attributes cannot be that he is created. He has to be eternal. And if he's eternal, it says the Earth and the universe were very good at creation, but then there was the fall. Well, it wasn't just the Earth that was subject to that, but the entire universe fell. And so I would say that, back to your original question, radioactive elements, that they decay as part of the fall process. Everything breaks down, wears out, and decays through time. Entropy is the word for that. And so if we lock this room up, come back here in 100 years, and it's still standing, it'll be all cobwebs and everything will be collapsed and broken. Certainly won't be the Ritz-Carlton. Okay? And that alone says that the universe didn't create itself and that it's not evolving to something better. It had to have been created by an external creator who's outside of the creation. There's no other way. Anyone that has half of a brain has to see that. How could the very laws that are tearing the universe down with time have created the universe? You know, Dr. Gish would use that argument, he'd win every debate. Over 300 times he debated and won every single one of them. You know, I'm not being biased, or just because he was a great man or my mentor, I'm not being biased. The evolutionists admit that he won every time with that argument. That and the fossil record. You know, as a paleontologist, I look at the fossil record. We do not find these intermediate forms. We don't find any
And yet you have to have billions of them if evolution is true, to go from simple organisms to macro organisms. We don't find, I don't see one, not one example. I've looked at the handful of organisms that they think might have been intermediates, like Archaeopteryx. They're not. They're not intermediates at all. There are no intermediates. The missing links are still missing. If evolution's a fact, and the Earth is 4.6 billion years old, we should have billions of intermediate forms showing how simple organisms evolve systematically into complex organisms. We don't find any. Boy, that is a huge mystery. What's the origin of matter? What's the origin of life? They can't even go into the lab and take non-living systems and create life. Can't do it. And yet, they have faith that, oh, somehow it evolved. Okay, well, I'm sorry, I don't have that much faith. I believe in science, and science demonstrates clearly that isn't true. So there must be some other better explanation. And then, you know, as I look at the Bible, I get mystified because the Bible has thousands of predictions about the future. We can test it all day long to see if it's accurate. And every single time, those predictions come true. Thousands of cases. Look at the book of Daniel alone, okay? Amazing. Predicts exactly when the Messiah would come and the Messiah would die. Amazing. Just amazing. Yes?
So what YouTube programs do you know that discuss entropy and the link, lack of link fossils or missing link fossils?
Go on YouTube and go Dr. Dwayne Gish and listen to some of his YouTubes, or Dr. Henry Morris are good ones. Or you can go to Answers in Genesis and just plug in the word entropy, and you'll get dozens of talks on that. Go to ICR, www.icr.org, and you'll find an abundance of talkers. Just put in that word, put in entropy. But Dr. Gish was a master. He was a PhD in biochemistry, and his lectures on the origin of life. It's like, if you were honest and sincere, you'd listen to that lecture, you could not walk out of there an atheist. There was no hope, and there is no hope that life came from non-life on its own. There's just too many parameters that are impossible to occur before you could get life. We can't do it now. We've gone into labs for 150 years, billions of dollars. All of our major universities have worked on this. Nobody can create life from non-life. So how did it evolve? Well, we're working on it. We'll get it. Really? Sorry, I don't have that much faith to be an atheist. I can't do it. I don't have that much faith. Why can't you do it? I mean, aren't we supposed to know that evolution occurred? You know, it's not just the negative evidence, like I mentioned. By the way, next week, you guys have got to go see this movie. How many of you guys seen that Lee Strobel, his life is, it's about his life, it's called The Case for Christ is coming out. Go to YouTube and go Case for Christ trailer, and you'll see on April the 7th, it's just fantastic. Because I follow Lee Strobel's career in life, because I highly respect him. And, you know, Lee Strobel was an atheist, and he was the editor for one of the big Chicago newspapers. And his wife befriended, you never know what can happen, his wife befriended a Christian lady, and a Christian lady shared with his wife, and his wife became a Christian. And he was so angry, he said, I'm going to disprove these doggone Christian once and for all. And so for almost 2 years, not quite 2 years, but almost 2 years, he studied evidence to refute what Christianity had to say, and guess what? He became a Christian. Okay? And today, he's probably one of the most prominent speakers. He's got hundreds of YouTube videos. He's got dozens of books out. If you have never read Lee Strobel books, they're fantastic. But there's a movie coming out. It's by PureFlix, and they do really good movies. PureFlix is the ones that did God Is Not Dead, God Is Not Dead Part 2. And April the 7th, it's coming out, and it's so cool to see that because, you know, as I'm getting older here, to get to see a young Lee Strobel, it's so cool. And he was an angry individual. So the guy that portrays him, he's kind of a hippie-looking guy with long hair and a mustache and stuff, and he's angry, and he's storming around. And then he said, I'm going to fix these Christians once and for all. I'll study it myself. Oh, whoops, it is true. And so I can't wait. It's exciting to see that. Listen, this Dr. John Morris, a good friend of mine, he's retired now, but he said it's an exciting time to be a creationist and a Christian. We're coming up with some fabulous research, like you've seen this, And more evidence, I'm just telling you, I will bet you my very life that we're correct. You know, I mean, how do we know? How do we know the, you know, Muslims or the Buddhists or any of those, how do we know they're not right? Well, I've studied all that and compared it to Christianity. Our case is so much better. Do you know that the founding fathers of almost all of our sciences, almost all of them, physics, chemistry, biology, they were all Bible-believing Christians. Johannes Kepler was a guy who essentially invented modern astronomy, came up with the laws of planetary motion, and Kepler said that he was thinking God's thoughts after him, and so because the universe is orderly, it's fallen, but it is orderly, that he could come up with laws based on the orderliness of the universe. And so that's how the scientific method was developed, by Bible-believing Christians that argued very, very strongly that, look, we can see the laws of nature, and because we can see the laws of nature were created and put in place by a creator designer, then there must be a creator. And so that's how they proceeded. And so today, you know, evolutionists, they forget that almost all of our sciences were founded by Bible-believing Christians, and yet, you know, they try to pretend like we're just these dumb country bumpkins that don't know anything when, you know, Christians, some of them are the most educated people in the world. They really are. Yeah. Other questions? We're getting low on time. Yes?
Did they ever argue that C-14 dating is not accurate?
Oh, of course. What else are they going to say? So they have to say there's some kind of contamination and we have to use...
I mean without contamination that the product...
Well, what they would say is it's precisely accurate back to 400 BC, and then after that, it has to be calibrated with some other methods like dendrochronology. So they wouldn't say it's precisely accurate year for year, but within reason, they would say it's accurate. Okay, and they would say, well, the method is just too short, so we can't date dinosaurs by it. You see, that's what Jack Horner says if you listen to that tape. Jack Horner would say, oh, well, dinosaurs, you know, went extinct 65 million years ago. C-14 runs out of carbon at about 100,000 years before present. We can't use the method. It's just too young, really. But what if you get discernible carbon in the dinosaurs? Oh, well, that has to be some kind of contamination, you see. Really? What do you base that on? Well, obviously, the Earth is 65, you know, the Earth is 4.6 billion years old, and dinosaurs died out 65 million. Well, how do you know that? Because evolution's a fact. Circles. Yes, sir.
Bill Hoesch will be speaking at Masters University on April 25th on a young Earth.
Ah, good.
He spoke here some 20 years ago that helped turn this church into what it is today.
That's good.
On a young Earth.
Yeah, I know Bill Hoesch. He's a good guy, and he's real smart, and that should be very interesting. His will be, I'm sure, several different systems that show a young Earth. And consistently, there are way more geochronometers, clocks, that show a young Earth than there are clocks that show an old Earth. And the ones that show an old Earth, as I've looked at them, I just see lots of problems and assumptions that are far greater than the ones that show a young Earth. Ultimately, boils down to faith of what you're going to believe. But like I said, I bet you my very life that the Bible is correct, and it seems to very strongly imply that the Earth is young. It doesn't give us a date, but it seems to very strongly imply that the Earth is young. So I have no reason to doubt that. I don't care what Pat Robertson says.
All right, one last question. We saw a movie recently, is Genesis History.
Yes.
Did you see it? I was wondering, do you know anything about that being available on DVD?
I don't. Have you tried Googling it? It was exciting because I know all the guys that were in there, and there are many of them good friends, like Steve Austin is just a super great guy, and a pretty good wrestler, too. Steve Austin. No, he's not a wrestler. He used to be a $6 million man, right? Same guy. Boy, he gets around. No, but seriously, I don't have any information on that, but I would try. Have you tried Googling it? I'm sure you'll be able to find it. Unfortunately, you saw that all the Christian family bookstores are going out of business. So I'm really sad about that because that is a major resource. But you can still get almost any books that you want at places like Barnes and Noble and stuff. Just have to special order them. I would be willing to bet that you'll be able to get that online. I'm sure it'll be carried.
It's out. I just saw $14.99.
Oh, good. Where are you finding it?
$2.
I'm sure it's on
Amazon.
Okay, you can get anything on the internet. Okay, any final questions? Challenge me. You guys are too easy. Come on.
So you all believe the same thing you do.
Yes?
Well, I'm the one in the room who's bucking for now. I want to ask a hard question.
Okay, good. I like hard questions. It means you're thinking.
So the other radio dating methods you talked about at the very beginning.
Yes.
I assume that the scientists who refuse to use the carbon-14 are going to use two or three of those methods. To date.
Yes.
And using those two or three methods, they come up with these 65-million-year-old questions. What if
yes.
you are wrong?
Okay, that's right. One of us is wrong. Now, I taught the physical science at the Master's College for 17 years, so I'm very aware uranium lead, rubidium strontium, and those potassium argon methods. We ran out of time, but my last couple of slides, those old age methods have, in my opinion, severe problems that make them untenable. For example, we have had known lava flows in Hawaii dated to the 1800s where you could see photographs of the area, okay? So we know when the lava flow actually happened, and they've been dated by potassium argon at 250,000 years before present. Boy, that creates some doubt. We also know that the decay rate of radioactive elements has not been stable for billions of years. This is a major assumption. We have gone into the lab and we have seen some changes in the decay rates. Now, there's a whole host of other problems. Unfortunately, you asked me this at the end of the night, but maybe Paul, you could bring up the slides again and bring up the last couple of slides, and I can talk some more with her after because it's getting late and I don't want to keep these folks, and that discussion would be very technical. You have to decide if you want to believe those dates, which I'm saying cannot be verified and have problems with them. And I can give you the references if you want to look these up yourself. Or you can decide that carbon-14, which has been checked over and over and over again, and every single fossil that we find has indigenous carbon in it. You have to decide which one is accurate. Not only that, but there are far more, as I mentioned. Henry Morse, the book, the back of the book, the Genesis record, is well over 100 geochronometers that show a young Earth. So really, after you've checked all these methods, I have for 35 years now, and I may be wrong, but I'm telling you, I bet my very life that I'm not. And that's the thing I have to lose the most. I'll challenge you to investigate it. I'll give you the references. You can investigate it a little more yourself. Decide. Okay. Yeah, if you go back.
I went to the very end. Is it the radiocarbon puzzle or?
It's after that. You'll see.
Main assumptions in radioactive plot?
Yes. Okay. Go to that slide. And we're done. So if you want to end the meeting, come up and end the meeting.
Yeah.
And then I'll talk to this lady if she'd like to do some more.
Yes. Okay.
All right, let's close in prayer, you guys. Our Father in heaven, my mind travels back again to Romans chapter 1. And the real issue that faced every one of us apart from Christ, that we by nature suppress the truth in unrighteousness, that we do not desire to honor you or give thanks to you or worship you or acknowledge any accountability to you, that in our fallenness apart from Christ, we are rebels and we want to be God. And yet we thank you that the Lord Jesus came to die for sinners who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And we do rejoice that the gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. We thank you, Lord, that you've opened our blind eyes and transformed our hearts, so that it is our desire, because of Christ, to magnify you as Creator, not to suppress the truth, but to uncover the truth, and to declare the excellencies of the God who's called us out of darkness and into light. Father, we know the issue ultimately is not one of evidence, because you yourself have made yourself known so that each human being is without excuse. And we who are guilty and sinful, we thank you that when we would not seek for you, you sought for us through the Lord Jesus, who came to seek and to save that which was lost. And thank you tonight, Father, that it is our desire to bring glory and honor to you, to make much of the Lord Jesus, to see ourselves in our puniness and our sinfulness and your great, amazing grace that rescued us when we could not and would not rescue ourselves. And so thank you tonight, Father. Your word is true, and thank you for this corroboration of the realities that your word teaches. You are the Creator and Lord. You've been merciful through Christ. And I do pray, Lord, in the days ahead that you would conform us to Christ all the more, that we would think your thoughts after you biblically and rightly and righteously. And so thank you for our opportunity to look at these things tonight and become confirmed all the more that your word is profitable for teaching, reproof, correction, training in righteousness. It is the inerrant word. It is the God-breathed word. And we worship you because of Christ and in Christ tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Well, let's thank David again. Thank you, David. Thank you. So if anybody would like to continue the dialogue, feel free to do that.